ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If someone wanted to hack you right now, how easy would it be? And is there anything you could do to stop them? You're listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Rae Johnston, and welcome to episode 3 of our special series, Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. In this series, I'm going to take you on my own personal journey towards a full internet opt out. From finding out how much of my highly personal info is out there, to figuring out how to scrub it from existence and lock it all down so it doesn't happen again. And episode 3 is all about figuring out how to lock down your online life and defend against hackers. Thousands of Aussies are caught up in scams or hacks every day. And as we heard in our last episode, this can impact your bank account, your ability to get a job, and your safety in the not online world. So I decided it was time to get serious about my cybersecurity, which basically means stop being the digital equivalent of someone who leaves their house keys in the front door overnight. We've been told for a while that long, complex passwords are safer than short, simple ones. But why? And who can be expected to memorize and maintain hundreds of unique passwords for things ranging from booking a dentist visit to online banking? It was time to call in someone who actually understands the maths behind all this stuff, cryptographer Vanessa Teague.
So why does personal security matter for the average person? I've had conversations with so many people that their response is, I've got nothing to hide. It doesn't matter if information about me is out there. So what is the risk of not taking it seriously?
It's really about autonomy and control. How much control are you letting the corporation or whoever breaks into your device have over you? So the implications of a loss of control can range from very obvious things like people breaking into your bank account and stealing your money, to less obvious things like surveillance associated with advertising, people find out what you're keen to buy, how much you're willing to pay for it, through to quite malevolent forms of political or psychological manipulation, finding out what politics you're interested in, what kinds of suggestion you're vulnerable to, and trying to influence or tilt you in a certain direction.
So how does that information get misused?
Well, all kinds of ways. Maybe it's better to think about how it gets out there in the first place. And I think a lot of people probably don't realise how much information about you is being gathered as you engage in your what feels like private internet browsing or app using activities. A lot of the apps on your phone and a lot of the websites that you use without thinking about it are actually gathering all kinds of information about you, who you're connected with, what your location is, what messages you're sending, what times you're awake, what things you're clicking on, and so on.
How do you recommend that people stay aware of the risks, but without feeling like they have to live off the grid? Because I'll be honest, I've had that feeling more and more recently.
Yeah, well, I don't know. The people who live off the grid might have the last laugh. But one thing that I would say is you can always go through your phone and delete everything you're not using. Mm. Right? You can always go through your permissions and turn off everything that shouldn't have permission. So, for example, I'm paranoid. I turn off location services altogether because I don't feel like I need it. But maybe you like it, right? Maybe you like your maps to have your location showing. But that doesn't mean that a zillion other apps that don't need to know where you are also need location permission. So you can go through your device, you can remove permissions for things that don't need them. You'd be astounded if you look at the permissions on either Android or iPhone, how many apps ask for permission for your microphone or your location that actually have no business listening to you or knowing where you are.
So encryption is something that gets, you know, talked about a lot, but what does it actually mean in practice? Can you talk to me a little bit about encryption and why it's so important for online privacy?
Absolutely. So this is actually my area. This is the thing I studied at uni for a long time. Let's just think about what happens when you send something over the internet, when you're browsing the web or you're interacting with an app and sending a message to your friend or whatever. Your device connects to the internet somehow, maybe through your home internet service provider, maybe through Wi-Fi at a cafe or something. That message goes through a series of intermediaries over the internet to the place that you're communicating with, whether it's downloading a video from YouTube, visiting the BBC, chatting to somebody on TikTok. It's going to some service provider somewhere. And potentially every hop on that long series of hops through the internet has access to your traffic, right? To both the messages that you send and the stuff that comes back to you. So it's really important that the details of what you're sending are encrypted, which means there's a key held by the server and your device uses encryption to obscure the actual content of what you're sending with the key. And then the server can decrypt the message, but none of the other intermediaries along the path can figure out the details of what you're sending or receiving.
So when we've had cases globally, I think of in the US in particular, where Apple, for instance, has been pressured by the government to unencrypt messages, that's not actually technically possible.
Correct. So, well, okay, let's add one more layer of complexity, because if the service provider is the endpoint of your encrypted channel, then they can decrypt your messages, right? If you're doing direct messages via TikTok or Discord, or if you're just visiting a website like YouTube, then the service provider is the endpoint of that message and they can decrypt. And in fact, they often do, and they often expose that information to advertisers or law enforcement or their corporate partners or whatever. The thing that's controversial is end-to-end encryption, which is offered by Apple iMessages, some cloud storage providers, the Signal app, WhatsApp, and a variety of other secure providers. End-to-end encryption means that the entity that holds the key is not the service provider, but the other person you're talking to. So if I send you a message on Signal, your Signal device holds the decryption key, and the Signal service is just forwarding an encrypted blob that they can't even read. So if somebody comes to them and tries to demand that they expose the message, they can't. And it's similarly for Apple iMessages and FaceTime, WhatsApp messages and a variety of other services. The end-to-end encrypted nature of the service means that even the service provider doesn't have the data.
Right. There are a lot of tools out there. Yeah, we're talking VPNs and password managers, two-factor authentication, multi-factor authentication. It's not difficult to get overwhelmed by all of the options out there. So what would you say is the simplest way to start improving your security online?
I would engage an end-to-end encrypted messaging platform whenever I can. I use Signal. You don't have to use Signal if you're already on iPhones and all your friends are on Apple. iMessage is pretty good. The idea that as the default communication mechanism, you use something end-to-end encrypted is a very good way of just starting a baseline of communications privacy. It's particularly important if you send anything intimate or personal or potentially that could be used against you, but it's also just kind of good practice for your life.
I'm curious as well, if you've got a perspective on this, if our data, it's our data, it's our information, technically we should have ownership over it. If it's being sold and repackaged without our consent, Are there bigger issues at play? You know, is this something that we could look at in terms of labour laws in Australia being compensated for that data? Or is this a case of, you know, the old adage, if you're on the internet and you're not paying for something, you are the product?
Well, that's certainly true. I would like to see better privacy reform. We've had privacy reform stalled in Australia for a very long time. It should be. A lot of the data practices that have become common should be illegal. They're not illegal. I think sharing data without consent, fake de-identification where they say there's a tremendous trade in data that has had your name stripped off but still easily identifies you, which kind of technically is illegal to trade without your consent, but which in practice is traded all over the place on the pretext that it's de-identified when it's really not. We could be cracking down on that and we're not.
Is it possible for someone to completely remove themselves from the internet or choose not to engage with the internet anymore? Has the horse bolted?
I think it's pretty sad that ordinary people's common use of computers is inevitably entangled with a constant violation of their privacy. Because the internet doesn't have to be like that and was not originally like that. For example, you could in principle communicate anonymously across the internet. You could put up your own website and share communications with others. There's nothing inherently about the internet that makes this kind of constant invasion of personal sovereignty and personal privacy inevitable. It's just it's a decision by a group of corporations and a consequence of weak regulation across the world.
Can we fight back?
I think answer number one is end-to-end encrypted services when you can. Another potential answer is virtual private networks or other forms of more private browsing. Note that I didn't say completely private browsing. So let's just go back to that discussion about what happens when you're sitting on your computer or using your phone from a cafe and you're communicating over the internet to the BBC or TikTok or YouTube or whatever? The progress of your packets over the internet is kind of visible to all of the intermediaries. And everybody along that chain knows basically which IP address you've come from, which gives them a fair idea of where you are, and which destination you're going to, which gives them a pretty good idea of which website you're visiting. Now, you might want to obscure that information from all of those intermediaries on the internet. So let's say, for example, I want to visit the BBC because I want to watch a good quality documentary. If I use the ordinary internet to do this, the BBC, which geo-blocks a lot of its content, is going to recognise that I'm coming from Australia and they're going to refuse to serve certain kinds of material. So what I could do is I could pay someone to act as a proxy inside the UK and I could say, I'm going to send my requests to the BBC to you first. I want you to forward them to the BBC, request that doco that I want to see, receive the information back from them and then forward it on to me. So as far as the BBC is concerned, it looks like I'm coming from inside the UK, but that proxy service inside the UK is just forwarding the information back to me. So that works great. That gets around the geo-blocking issue, and it means that I can effectively pretend to be in the UK even though I'm not. Now, it doesn't solve the privacy problem because that proxy still knows exactly who I am and what I'm looking at, but it solves the pretending to be somewhere else problem. So, but it's kind of limited because I've only got that one server. If I want to pretend to be in Canada or China or somewhere else, that's not useful. So a virtual private network is just a network of those kinds of services.
So using encryption and using a VPN, is there anything else that you would advise people to stay more safe and secure online?
I mean, there's the obvious kind of dumb thing to just say, don't upload stuff that you don't need to upload. Don't share information that you don't need to share. I think there's been a lot of discussion about, for example, banning people from social media. I think there should be a lot more discussion about just not necessarily sharing a great deal of information with social media if you don't need to.
So the key to privacy is being a little bit more private, maybe.
Correct.
You're listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Rae Johnston, and after talking to Vanessa, I had that horrible moment of clarity where you realize, oh, I am the problem. I downloaded a password manager, and let me tell you, nothing makes you feel quite like an adult, like finally cleaning up your digital junk drawer. But then, of course, you fix one thing and suddenly you can see everything else that's broken, like, do I need two-factor authentication? Should I be using a VPN? Why does every app on my phone want to sync my contacts? What even is, when it comes down to it, a security key? Time to call someone who speaks fluent cyber panic. Enter Carter Smith from CyberCX.
Hey Ray, I'm Carter. I'm a cybersecurity consultant based in Darwin. I work at a company called CyberCX. We're one of Australia's largest cybersecurity companies. My sort of background is around security testing and hacking, but I have a sort of keen focus on what people expose on the internet and how, you know, adversaries can use that against them. So I find a lot of my time I spend identifying, finding people on the internet.
You are the exact person that I want to be speaking to then, because this is something that has occupied my mind more and more lately, as we're required in a lot of instances to put more and more information about ourselves on the internet. One of the things that I've been curious about is my home address. Did that happen to come up in your research at all?
I haven't found that, no.
Ah.
But I wasn't looking too deeply at, you know, where you live.
Excellent.
You know, it's the first time we've spoken, so I didn't want to step off on the wrong foot.
Totally understand. So we hear the term cyber hygiene bandied around a little bit more these days. It can sound pretty technical. Are we as individuals getting any better at protecting ourselves online, or do we tend to be falling into the same traps?
I guess unpopular opinion. No, I think we're getting worse. The more we the more we get online, the more we do online, the more it becomes sort of part of our day to day. I guess the more we forget about securing ourselves and what we should be doing. In my line of work, for sort of finding people on the internet and things like that, you know, it's just sort of simple things that people forget about. Or, you know, you have conversations with people and they're like, oh, you know, it's just, there's been so many data breaches that, you know, my data doesn't matter anymore. Or, you know, it's out there, why bother? But, you know, believe me, your privacy matters.
It does almost feel like as though, as a society, we are being worn down a little bit.
Absolutely.
For feeling more comfortable to having our information out there. Like you've said, you know, the attitude of, there's already so much out there about me. What more does a little bit more matter? I'm hearing that more and more. Is that something that concerns you?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, with the rise of things like generative AI and things like that, you know, they've just become so ingrained in our lives. You know, you turn to ChatGPT and ask it simple things, or, you know, you start feeding it information. And you know, that's really dangerous when you, I guess, as the layperson may not sort of understand, is these models and these tools like ChatGPT and Gemini and things like that, they'll learn based on the information that you provide. Machine learning is sort of a relatively new field in terms of like this sort of generative AI. You know, if you think back 5 years ago, no one knew what ChatGPT was. But as it sort of becomes more ingrained in our lives, we become dependent on it, and it's sort of a crutch. But, you know, people aren't really conscious of what information they are collecting, but also what information they're using to sort of train their models. Machine unlearning is something that's sort of foreign. You know, once it's in there, there's no sort of getting it back. It's similar to, you know, if you think back 5 or so years ago, people were saying, yo, be careful what you post online, you can't get it back. It's a very similar thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting to adjust our thinking in that way. You know, once our information is in these data sets that are being fed into these generative AI models, getting it removed feels impossible.
Yeah, it is pretty much impossible. There are so many different layers where it's taken and used in models and training and things like that. Once it's in that training data set, there is no way to remove that information unless you retrain the whole model, which, you know, they spend months and millions of dollars on. So, you know, one person's bit of data is not gonna sway that.
What would be some of the most common mistakes that you see everyday people making with their online security?
Yeah, it's interesting. So in my line of work, obviously, sort of finding people on the internet, I'd say sort of 50% of the time it's on, I'll say target. It's a very surgical word. but it's 50% of the target. And I said 50% of, you know, their close network when we're talking about what people post online. You know, people make sort of simple mistakes of posting things like their kids in school uniforms, you know, where they go and do Pilates, you know, where they live, you know, I just sold my house or I just bought a house. Here's a photo of me out the front of my house. And, you know, making those types of posts, when you take all of what you posted and sort of look at the timelines and where you've posted, you can sort of build out patterns of life, like they live here, they work here and things like that. And, you know, that to the everyday person, you might think that's not sort of important, but it's information that probably doesn't have to be there.
We've been doing a little bit of research into how much data gets collected about us behind the scenes that we are unaware of. But I wanted to ask you about the risks that we invite in on ourselves. Are there any modern versions of don't click suspicious links, even though that's still relevant advice?
Yeah. You know, that's information that is being collected that you might not know about. There's so much information that's being collected that you're actually consenting to. You know, I can tell you firsthand, like, unless you're a lawyer, there's no way you're reading those terms and services or terms and conditions and those privacy policies whenever you sign up to some random service. But what you find is a lot of those services, you know, even apps you're downloading and stuff like that, they're collecting a lot of information and selling it. And you've consented to that sale of your information by clicking, I accept these terms and conditions, or by even just using the application. And, you know, a lot of the time that's used for marketing and stuff, but, you know, you can use that sort of for nefarious purposes. And it's not a matter of, like, how many dollars does it cost to buy information on Ray or Carter? It's a matter of cents. You know, you can buy whole data sets of whole countries' information for not very much.
How much are we talking?
We'll say maybe for all of Australia, you look at, you know, 20-odd million profiles. You know, you can look at maybe a few thousand dollars.
You're kidding. So millions, tens of millions of profiles for a couple of thousand dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And you can even be more targeted with some of these services that exist where you can just look up individuals for, you know, matters of cents.
Unreal. So thinking about scams, they're getting harder and harder to spot, particularly now that AI has entered the chat, generative AI more specifically. What should people be looking out for now? I know that AI-generated videos are getting harder and harder to distinguish from real videos, but is there anything happening in the scam world using generative AI that people might not be aware of?
Yeah, there's actually a lot, and a lot of it's targeting businesses. You know, the general public may not be aware of a lot of these things because they're not necessarily the victims. But if you look at businesses, they lose millions and millions of dollars weekly or daily to these types of attacks across the world. I'll use some quite technical terms in this sort of next bit, but I'll sort of do my best to explain them. So pretexts is what we call, I guess, the story behind these scams. What we're finding is these threat actors, who are, you know, essentially groups of organized criminals that operate on the internet, they're using things like generative AI to create deepfake voices. So they'll call up just like how regular people call up their service desk because they forgot their password, but they'll get the voice of a prominent person in that business, normally like a CEO or someone that's, you know, done a lot of talking on the internet, and they'll train up a generative model, create a sort of soundboard with some sort of common answers to questions and things like that. They'll then call the service desk or call individuals and try to get them to do certain actions. And when you get a phone call from your CEO, you're like, oh, wow, I have to do this, sort of forget about everything else. So they're super, super effective techniques. And in my line of work, doing these types of education engagements and stuff like that with the right approvals and things like that, because doing this without approvals is obviously a crime. I found that, you know, there's quite a large increase in success rates of these types of phishing or scam campaigns when you're using like trusted voices, especially if you're assertive and especially if it's someone sort of in power. And these threat groups and these criminals often do that, and they often use these types of techniques to extort or steal money.
One of the things that we've spoken about a bit is password managers. And I've heard from a few people that they're uncomfortable using them because it feels like putting all your eggs in one basket. If that one password manager password is revealed, then someone has all of them. Is that the case? Are they still the best option?
I am a massive fan of password managers. I think when you look at it, it's like a risk assessment, right? What's the risk of you using the same password everywhere and your accounts being compromised versus what's the risk of a business whose business model is to secure your data being compromised? And obviously, as a nerd, I've read through the security white papers from 1Password and stuff like that. And I have confidence in, they have zero knowledge of any of your sensitive information. All of the data is sort of encrypted. It's obviously stored on their servers and stuff like that. So if someone was to compromise them, they could get a hold of that information. But there are multiple layers to it. You know, you've got your password for your password manager. That's one layer. But you can have a secondary like key. Some of these password managers are rolling this out where it's sort of like double encrypted. So even if someone steals your password for your password manager, they still need to this sort of access key to be able to get all of the information in it. And the other thing as well is using multi-factor and a really strong type of multi-factor. So I use a hardware multi-factor. You know, like back in the day, you'd go to the bank and you have this little like button on a key. It's called a YubiKey. There's a sort of other variations of it, but that's a sort of major brand. They're about $50. So they're pretty insignificant. And, you know, I can sleep well at night knowing that I use a physical multi-factor to get into my password manager. And that if someone really wanted to steal my information, they'd have to rock up to my house and take that little sort of USB off of me.
So, Carter, if you had to narrow it down to one thing that people could do right now to be safer online, what would it be?
Yeah, if I could narrow it down to one thing, it would be conscious of what you post online. Before you post something about yourself or especially your mates, think, what could someone do with this information? How could it be exploited? And, you know, what could an adversary do with that? So it's that sort of second order thinking of, what am I posting? Where am I posting it? Do I need to be posting this?
So now I've got authentication codes popping up on my phone, apps shouting for updates, and I've learned that there are about 11 different types of two-factor authentication. But Carter said something I can't stop thinking about, the huge gap between people who can navigate this stuff and people who are basically just trusting the universe not to hack them. Because this takes time and patience and a not insignificant level of tech understanding, which got me thinking back to what Vanessa said about asking individuals to carry way too much of the burden. As we've heard from Vanessa Teague and Carter Smith, staying safe online doesn't have to be complicated. Vanessa reminds us to use strong passwords and two-factor authentication, while Carter urges us to think twice before posting anything personal. It is absolutely worth it to get a password manager, and it is much safer than trying to remember a new variation of your pet's name and date of birth every year. It all takes the memorizing out of the equation and exponentially increases your safety online. Next time on Download This Show's special series Opt Out, I dig into the fine print, the terms and conditions we never read, and the hidden traps sitting behind every accept or okay that you click online. That's it for episode 3 of Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. You can listen to all the episodes of our special series now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ray Johnston, and this has been another episode of Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.